My name is Bill Giddings. I'm from Pacific Lutheran University. The title this morning is Energy and Environment in the Pacific Northwest, Choices for the 1980s. Now that title is so long because it represents a two-day conference at the Evergreen State University in Olympia, Washington, which took place last Friday and Saturday. It's also so long because it was designed by a committee one snowy day last January. Now, I actually voluntarily left Holden Village for a few days to attend this conference, so I want to make it even more worthwhile by sharing with you this morning some of the things that went on there. In the schedule, priority was given in placing as the first session the one entitled Philosophy of Energy Use. This also got extra priority by being the only unopposed schedule session on the program. We understand how that goes here at Holden also. The opening paper in that session was given by Gilbert Lafreniere from Willamette University, and he drew on his background in geology and history and in philosophy in addressing the question of worldviews and environmental ethics. He told us that a worldview is your implicit or explicit cosmological outlook, which includes a philosophy or interpretation of world history. He quoted John Passmore as describing the task of the philosopher as being to clear away the rubble of old world views. The Greeks and the Romans, we were told, viewed time as either being cyclical, going round and round over and over again without a beginning or an end, or as an incomprehensible flux of events, again without any beginning or end. This view was replaced after the fall of Rome by the medieval view, which brought in the idea of providence. Time then had a beginning, the creation, and an ending, the last judgment. Also, purpose, God's purpose. And God's purposes were known to people through the scriptures and through other channels of revelation. St. Augustine in the City of God described the aim of all events of history to be the placing of a limited number of souls in a preferred position, or so we were told. Today, this kind of a view of providence as controlling history is allegedly shared by Secretary of the Interior James Watt, among others. The scientific revolution, which began in the 16th century, largely replaced the idea of providence by a new worldview, the idea of progress. Now, progress could either be taken to mean an increase in the sum total of scientific knowledge, and this increase might possibly, as a side effect, lead to social and moral improvement, but nothing guaranteed. Or progress could be taken as the view that continual betterment in all realms is certain, is the guaranteed course of history, that history inevitably moves in a desirable direction if progress is your worldview. That view continued to grow from the 16th through the 19th century. It may still be dominant in some circles, but others, particularly since Hiroshima, take instead what's called a utopian view. That is one which sets up some concept of what a desirable direction for society would be, and then leaves it up to us to work together towards bringing about a movement in that direction. Achieving whatever utopia we might choose takes more than the efforts of professors and students in classrooms. We were told that we have to proselytize, and we should take our cue from the medieval monasteries and set up ecosteries as models of a more desirable society, And it occurred to me immediately, of course, that perhaps that's a new word for Holden Village. In the second paper, Alan Drengson, a philosopher from the University of Victoria, pointed out the difficulty we have in comparing world views without occupying one ourselves. When he went to school, the autonomic nervous system in biology was defined as being beyond personal control. Now, biofeedback has developed techniques for controlling the heartbeat and all sorts of other things still called part of the autonomic nervous system. Similarly, the concern for appropriate technology, in quotes, has moved away from those questions of what is appropriate and why is it appropriate to emphasis primarily on specific techniques for solving practical problems. Technology, he reminded us, is not just hardware, but also must include procedures for interacting with that hardware. Without the procedures, we can't tell a tool from a toy or from an object of worship. This interaction, though, takes place not only between us and our technology, but also with the natural environment. The byproducts of technology already affect every living being on the earth. The Norwegian philosopher Arne Næss, he said, defined the shallow ecology response to this situation as including those attempts to legislate surface solutions to problems of environmental interaction without trying to make any deep changes in the way we go about things. By contrast, the deep ecology movement views consciousness as being a network which we share not just with other human beings, but with other living beings whom we also should honor and respect. The final paper in that opening session on the philosophy of energy use was given by Gunolf Mirbo of Pacific Lutheran University's philosophy department. He focused on how we may make rational social choices about energy and the environment. He viewed rational social choices as unlikely to emerge either from the boardrooms of corporations or from the enclaves of experts and government agencies, because those people cannot possibly know enough to be able to make fully rational decisions. Social choices affect large numbers of individuals, and therefore, to be rational must be arrived at by some process which involves the participation of large numbers. This is not always easily accomplished, but it is necessary, in Professor Mirbo's view, if we are to be able to choose options that have the greatest total value, which should be the aim of rational decision making. He referred to risk-benefit analysis as being the fastest growing non-discipline in the country. Distinguish between costs associated with choices, which are predictable and certain, and risks, which must be weighed according not only to the possible cost, but to the likelihood that a costly event would occur. It is not irrational, in his view, to choose a risky option instead of a costly one, if you are able to measure these risks and weigh them objectively. One implication this has for social decision making is that people appear to be willing to assume voluntarily risks that may be 1,000 times as great as those they're willing to have imposed upon us by other people. And so whether a particular social choice is the best one may depend largely on whether or not the risks involved are freely chosen by those who bear them. Thus, Professor Mirbeau sees the proper role of planners and experts as being the preparation and presentation of careful analyses of costs and of risks of various possible plans, then necessarily for the public to discuss these plans and convey to the planners what their preferences are, then for the planners to produce recommendations in the light of the public desires, but once again for the public to make the final choice, so that the planners may be viewed not as the enemy, but as assistants in reaching the desirable outcome. During an afternoon session which dealt with regional energy resources, George Masinko from the Central Washington University Geography Department examined likely energy choices for the Pacific Northwest for the rest of the century. Hydropower, he told us, is nearly all developed in that there are already more demands on the Columbia River system for power, for irrigation, and for fisheries than it can now meet. Although further expansion of irrigation, he told us, was grossly uneconomical in terms both of the subsidies it requires and of the amount of hydroelectric power that would be foregone by taking more irrigation water from the river system, still there are plans for extensive further areas to be irrigated. In the Pacific Northwest Power Act, recently passed by Congress, priority is given to not just protecting, but restoring fisheries on the Columbia River system. Again, if done, this will be necessarily at the expense of some hydroelectric power that we've grown accustomed to using. Professor Masinko does not see much evidence that priority is being given in a meaningful way to conservation and renewable energy resources other than hydro, although the Power Act does require those as priority. And he further does not expect that solar and geothermal will become significant energy resources in the Pacific Northwest within the next 20 years. The nuclear industry here is in trouble. There may be some of you here from other parts of the country that don't know that the Washington Public Power Supply System, more or less affectionately known as WPS, started to build 5 large nuclear power plants at the same time. Since that time, because of more than 6-fold cost increases, because of financing difficulties in the bond market, and because of sharply reduced forecasts of future power demands, 2 of those nuclear plants have been canceled, and 1 more has been slowed down more than already had taken place. For these reasons, Professor Masinko sees coal as the only likely source for new electricity in this region for the balance of the century, to the extent that any increase in demand, however smaller than previously was predicted, any increase in demand will require an increase in production if it's to be satisfied. Cost comparisons that have been done over the years between coal and nuclear power come out pretty comparable in cost depending on exact assumptions that you may make. A study by the National Academy of Sciences a few years ago was unable to conclude whether coal or nuclear power has the greater risk because you can't really compare directly and precisely the quite different kinds of risks that either of these options present. So if these 2, cost and risk, seem to be pretty much a standoff, we might ask, why does coal seem preferable for this region here and in the immediate future? For one thing, many of the well-known dangers of coal, the number of miners that are killed every year, the greater number that come to suffer from black lung disease, the impacts of acid rain, all of these dangers of expanded use of coal or continued use of coal apply most heavily to eastern underground coal, which is higher in sulfur. Here in the Pacific Northwest, coal, if mined, would be strip mined, which is much safer, and it has a very low sulfur content. So the risks of coal seem less here than some other places. Further, development of coal is less capital intensive than nuclear power plants, and thus becomes less affected by higher interest rates and tight bond markets that he, for one, doesn't see changing completely within the next few years. Of course, then coal is much more affected by the cost of fuel, but that's spread over the years. Coal in the state of Washington, he told us, is found mainly in the Western Cascades. It's found in thin, offset, tilted seams and isn't of the best quality, which explains why only one coal field near Centralia is in commercial use. Further, reclamation after strip mining is much easier here, where we do get rain, than it is, for example, in Montana and Wyoming. Although he showed us some slides of the coal strip projects in Montana, which are being reclaimed very successfully, even though that's much harder to do than it is at Centralia, which is also a model of the reclamation process. Next, Grant Bailey, representing the URS Company, a consulting firm in Seattle, described the Creston coal-fired power plants and the Skagit Hanford nuclear plants, both of which projects are currently in the final stages of licensing approval. Even if licensed soon, however, that's no guarantee when or if they will actually be built, but those are the projects which, apart from the WHOOPS projects that have been canceled, are the ones closest to being ready to go. Both of those projects involve private utilities, in contrast to the Washington public power supply system. The Creston project also involves public utilities from Eugene and Seattle. The Creston plants, if built, are to be located 60 miles due west of Spokane. The coal to fire them will come most likely from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, being brought in two or three unit trains a day of, say, 110 cars each. The water required by these plants would come from wells which are adjacent to and presumably then fed by the Columbia River system. No water discharge other than evaporation to the atmosphere would occur from those Creston coal-fired plants. There are concerns addressed in the environmental impact statement, concerns about the effects of bringing 2,400 people employed directly in the construction process in an area where the town of Creston, 2 miles away, has a population of less than 350 now. There are concerns about air quality, as there always must be with coal-fired plants. A group calling themselves the Blue Sky Coalition has succeeded in achieving the status of intervener and getting hearings reopened that had already once been concluded on the licensing process. The Skagit-Hanford project would involve two nuclear plants, those planned by a consortium of private utilities with Puget Sound Power and Light as the lead one. They were first planned to be built in the Skagit Valley, but that location has been canceled, and the applications are in for permits to build them on the Hanford Reservation, 2 miles away from the living and dead WHOOPS plants. The cooling water for those plants would be brought again from the Columbia River there would be some discharge of much smaller amounts of warmed water and chlorinated water back to the Columbia, so those are questions that need to be addressed in an environmental impact statement. In this case, the estimated 4,500 workers to be involved at the peak of construction would not pose a problem to the area, since a plentiful supply of laid-off workers are already there that had begun building the Whoops number 4 that's been canceled and will become more available as work on number 2 and number 1 becomes completed in the next few years. So the major concerns for the Skagit Hanford plants are, is the power actually going to be needed? After all, two other plants have been canceled, largely on the basis of projecting the power not to be needed. Also, concern over the impact on fisheries of withdrawing that much more water and returning some of it used back to the system. The inevitable question was raised from someone in the audience, why don't they just buy the canceled plants that are already well on their way to being constructed? And of course, the man speaking was just from the company working on the environmental impact statement. He has no avenue into the corporate decision makers as such, but the things that they've been told is that they plan, if they build, to build two at the same time, two of the same kind, and two at the same site because of the economies that this provides. The two plants that were canceled are not at the same site, and so that couldn't be done. Furthermore, a considerable amount of equipment had already been purchased for the Skagit Hanford project, equipment which is not compatible with the plants already under construction for the Washington Public Power Supply System. And those that may or may not build the Skagit Hanford plants figure that they haven't got much better chance of unloading equipment they've already bought than the Whoops people do. So that's where that is now. If more plants are built, they will probably be one or both of those projects sometime, perhaps being completed within this century. I also attended a morning-long session by John Baldwin of the University of Oregon, which dealt with community energy plans. Does anybody here know that your community, your city, your county has an energy plan? There are over 2,000 community energy plans extant today. These only come about after an elaborate process, which we hope represents the rational decision making that Professor Mirbeau talked about the first morning. If you're interested in working on getting a community energy plan in your own area, first, local laws and local programs involving energy use need to be identified, and many data need to be gathered about the local energy resources and the use patterns that may exist in that particular area. Use patterns not only now, but some historical background to see where things are going, and a careful analysis of what use patterns may be expected in the future with such changes as seem likely to take place. There have been some significant changes since 1978 in the patterns of energy use, he told us. Generally, industrial energy use is down. He didn't say it, but I might add that there are two obvious reasons for it. One is the considerable attention industry has given to doing things in a more cost-effective way as energy prices have gone up. And the other, of course, has been the reduced level of industrial activity that you read about in the financial pages. Also, the total use of gasoline for transportation is down from 4 years ago. Significantly. On the other hand, the total amount of residential and commercial use is up nearly the same amount, so that the total use is about the same as in 78, but there's somewhat different mix. And in planning for the next two decades, you need to be very careful to try to identify what kinds of changes need to be planned for. Specifically, you need to project into the future what the local demand for electricity, for oil, and for natural gas will be, and for coal. The demand, the expected supply to be available, and the costs. He cautioned us that it seems certain that the cost of natural gas is going to skyrocket within the next few years, which may change greatly the desirability of planning extended use of natural gas, even where it is available, as it is in the Pacific Northwest at present. Yes, sure.
When you say it's going to skyrocket in the near future, is that going to mean it's going to be far more costly than an electric type heat or coal type heat? Or is it still going to be less costly than, say, electric heat, just a lot more than it is now?
Well, that's obviously not a simple question.
No, because I know the rate is
how much electricity will cost in the future will depend on variety of things that are still kind of uncertain, largely on how much additional generating capacity is needed, because any new electricity is going to be the expensive kind. How much natural gas will go up, it will be quite a bit compared to what it is now, because he sees, one, supplies becoming less favorable as natural gas is released that's been being held back because of the very low price that the federal government has imposed on natural gas that moves across state lines. And he sees the direction of easing of that price control way beyond what the value is compared to other energy sources will necessarily bring the price up to be, I suppose, competitive, we would say, with coal and electricity, and if electricity comes from coal, then those prices are necessarily tied together. Are who are participating in those projects: Washington Water Power, which is headquartered in Spokane, the Eugene City Utility, the PNWG Company, which Pacific Northwest Generating Company, I guess, which is an Oregon utility, Puget Sound Power and Light, which is Western Washington and Oregon, and Seattle City Light. Although the amount of power which each of those is now scheduled to obtain comes out to be below what the original amount of power that the projects would be designed to produce might be, so it could very well be that power would be sold to other parts of the country, at least at the beginning, just as the power from the Centralia coal-fired plant, although, again, Washington and Oregon utilities own that plant. A lot of that power has gone to California at the beginning because you want to sell all the power you produce from the day you add 1,000 or 2,000 megawatts to the total amount available.
Can I ask one final
sure.
question? Same subject. It's an interest to me because, well, my hometown is, you know, open arms about it, the whole neighborhood is. They're all taking up sides, you know. And there are all this talk about acid rain on the farmlands down there. I know, because my father will be 90 in 2 months, I know
to be no question that, particularly in the northeastern United States, literally dozens of lakes in the Adirondack Mountains have become sterilized, absolutely void of life, because they are now acid. They were not acid 20 years ago. Why? The major suspicion points in two directions. One is a nickel smelter in Sudbury, Ontario, which has cut down, I think, by 75% on its emissions, and B, dozens and dozens of coal-fired plants in the Ohio Valley and other places. In the Pacific Northwest, according to what I heard at an acid rain conference last spring, it is still uncertain whether actual effects can be documented. It is certain that the acidity of rainfall, at least on the western Cascade Slope, is increasing. It is also certain that the particular kinds of lakes with the kinds of vegetation and underlying rock that are located there are susceptible to damage, but how much it will take before the damage is visible or irreversible, one cannot say. Now, I wonder what the size was of the particular coal-fired plant you talk about compared to the 2,032 megawatts net capacity that's on the drawing board now. We can be certain there were no pollution controls on that previous plant. We can be certain there will be some, but we cannot be certain to what extent they will be required on these new plants, because we don't know what exactly the regulations will be at the time they're actually constructed. So I would say the concern is very real, but it's a question of risk analysis, and the probabilities of damage cannot be calculated precisely. Might just mention in passing, since the time is still remaining, that acid rain is what we call it, but you know better than I that rain isn't very abundant right around there. And I heard the figure that something like 90% of the acid will come down not in rain, but in dry form, either as gases in the air or on solid particles settling out. And the impact of that can be somewhat different from the impact of acid dissolved in raindrops. It's much more difficult to measure, and it's much more difficult to assess what the effects actually are. Yes, sir? We're talking about the so-called Creston coal-fired power plants, which are, what did I say?
And it's surrounded by Wilbur 8 miles away, Devonport 19 miles away.
They're
around
25
miles from Grant's Dam. At that pinpoint,
it's 6 to 7 miles from Colcan.
At that pinpoint.
These can take various forms, some in the forms of incentives, tax write-offs, for example, some in the forms of regulations. You shall, in order to get a building permit, do the following, and others in the way of performance standards. An example of the last in the energy plan for Davis, California, it sets a figure for a maximum amount of heat loss through the attic of a home. That standard may be met any way you like, as long as you can demonstrate that no more heat
requires the homeowner to do everything in the next 5 years to weatherize the home that is cost effective. So that's the way the regulation is. And cost effective, of course, has to be designed. Cost effective to the Portland regulation is anything which will pay for itself in the next 10 years. Ashland, Oregon has a solar access ordinance. It does no good to install solar collectors or design a passive solar house if it's going to be shaded by your neighbor's tree or buildings. The way the solar access ordinance is defined in Ashland is if you imagine a 6-foot fence along your south lot line, then the shadow is not to extend over that hypothetical 6-foot fence anytime between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. on January 21st. Figuring if you're protected at that time, you'll be protected during the rest of the year where the sunlight is more abundant. Since that solar access ordinance was passed in Ashland, 20% of the new construction applications in Ashland have included some provision for solar energy. Ordinarily, 2-3% of new applications include provision for solar energy. So again, the community energy plan has made a difference. Other success stories include Crystal City, Texas, which you may have read about as being the rural Hispanic community in South Texas that was cut off by the natural gas company, so their community energy plan had to be developed very quickly. They developed alternative energy sources to the extent that when the gas company wanted to hook up again, they had to lower their rates before the citizens were willing to hook up again. And another success story, in San Bernardino, California, the Westside Community Development Corporation was formed in a disadvantaged area. They produced a program to provide solar hot water and substantial solar heating to a 2-block area of that decaying part of town. They developed manufacturing companies for solar greenhouses and flat plate solar collectors. In these manufacturing companies, they employ and train disadvantaged minority teenagers. And once they've been through the company training programs, these youths, who may have nationally 50 or 60% unemployment rate, have a 99% record of job placement for graduates of these programs in the industry or in trades. Well, the one thing he mentioned was they developed a way of making charcoal out of mesquite for heating and cooking, I guess. And I don't know really what else. He didn't have time to go into a great amount of detail. He referred us to a book called Shining Examples, which I haven't tried to obtain yet. But these are just some, again, of the ones he felt were most worth mentioning, of the over 2,000 that have actually been developed and adopted by the local government agencies. The final session which I attended dealt with the question of deregulation, which is something that a great deal has been said about by the present administration and Congress. There was a panel made up of representatives of industries and of state agencies, and unanimously they said they hadn't seen any deregulation yet. Deregulation to them would be desirable if it meant simpler but equally effective ways of meeting environmental needs and standards. The industry representatives point out that there's no way they can clean up if their competitors don't also have to match that. And so they welcome regulations if the regulations are appropriate in their view for the ends that they achieve. Instead, all of the panelists were concerned that what deregulation is meaning seems to be just a decrease in funding of agencies. One in the audience pointed out that a couple of entire floors of the federal building in Seattle now stand vacant, but that hasn't affected the particular local industries or local pollution control agencies. On both sides, the regulator and the regulatee, they felt that the adversary system that is set up is not the most efficient or the most effective approach, that there's entirely too much process involved in the regulatory process now, but that a more cooperative approach, if it becomes simply a euphemism for failure to regulate, would not be desirable, again from the point of view either of the industry or of the agencies charged with protecting the public. They pointed out that the laws, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and others, are still on the books. Congress has not passed any sweeping revisions. All that's happened so far is some minor tinkering with the regulations. Polls which have been taken by national polling agencies show that an overwhelming majority of the population still want regulation, still feel that clean air, clean water are desirable and necessary goals. But there was considerable concern expressed that if you simply don't give the financial support needed to enforce regulations, then without changing the law, you have simply deregulated by ignoring the situation. Does this give rise to any questions or comments among you? Do you agree that clean air and clean water are still high priorities that should be achievable? I'm sure that they were not counting at all on the public conserving for a couple of reasons. One, they had no history to support that idea. The plans for these plants were well on their way to being developed before 1973, when the Arab oil embargo first shocked much of the American public into believing that conservation might be a good idea. So the projections that they were operating on were simply more of the same. And secondly, they view as their moral and legal obligation, and I've heard this both from public utility and private utility people, that regardless of their own preferences, they are obliged to supply all the power that customers want without asking any questions of what they want it for. This was at least their pattern of thinking. Now some things have changed. In Seattle, for example, you can't get hook up for electric heating unless you can show that your house meets certain insulation standards. But when the projections were first made, on the basis of all the data available at that time, it wasn't altogether unreasonable to expect that the future would be like the past, only more so. And one of the biggest problems with the projecting business is that it takes over 10 years between the time you decide, yes, we will build this nuclear power plant in this location, and the time anybody gets any power out of it. And if, pardon? Yeah, it's been running 11-12, actually. And so, could any of us 10 years ago have predicted not only slower growth, but no growth and actual another problem, cost overruns. Who 10 years ago could possibly have predicted interest rates peaking at over 20%? This would have been completely inconceivable back when the original plans were being made. And it becomes, again, a matter of social decision-making as to how that those rates are apportioned. Historically, the basis on which charges were made were on cost of service. Well, it costs so much to send out a bill every month, so regardless of how big that bill is. So everybody pays something whether they use any power or not if they're hooked up. It costs so much to string lines, and of course it costs more to string big lines than small ones, but those costs are shared by all of the people on those particular lines. And once the lines are in and the books are in operation and so forth, then it costs relatively little to supply a lot of power as to supply a little power. The complete turnaround is that it used to be actually cheaper to produce more power than to produce a little power. A large plant operates more economically per kilowatt hour than a small one. But when we're in the location where all the cheap power is spoken for, and any increases are very expensive power, whether coal or nuclear, then it's a whole different ballgame. And it's also a different ballgame depending on whether you're a private industry, a private utility, or a public utility, because of the unique arrangement of the Bonneville Power Administration as the federal marketing agency for the energy generated at the dams built by the U.S. Corps of Engineers or the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation.